Our final case is Sanitary Board of the City of Charleston versus Wheeler. We have Mr. Niffler.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yes, sir.
So you're going to talk to us for 10 minutes, and then Mr. Teeny is going to talk to us for 5 minutes before we move to Ms. Roundtree. Does that sound right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Have at it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Paul Niffler, representing the Sanitary Board of Charleston, West Virginia. Question for the court is whether Congress's inclusion of the phrase substantially prevailing party in 33 U.S.C. section 1365D allows courts to award attorney's fees under the catalyst theory or requires courts to ignore the phrases substantially prevailing party and whenever appropriate and only award attorney's fees upon entry of an enforceable judgment on the merits. Supreme Court in Ruckelshaus stated that statutes contain varying standards as to the precise degree of success necessary for an award of fees. And then it separately noted the categories of prevailing party and substantially prevailing party. The first category are statutes that contain prevailing party, and these are described in Buchanan, and they require a judgment on the merits before attorney's fees can be awarded. In Buchanan, the statutes involved were the Fair Housing Amendments Act and the ADA, both of which were prevailing party statutes. The second category are statutes that award fees whenever appropriate under the catalyst theory, where a party receives a substantial relief prior to the judgment on the merits. Now, the Clean Water Act itself is unusual because Section 1365D allows an award of attorney fees to, quote, any prevailing or substantially prevailing party whenever appropriate.
Well, let me, in the Hart case, I think that's it, from the Supreme Court, the court divided up fee awards into four general categories: prevailing party, substantially prevailing party, where appropriate, and discretionary. So is it your view that the catalyst theory would apply to awards under a where appropriate or discretionary standard?
Yes, it would apply to both of those, yes, Your Honor, as well as the substantially prevailing party.
Okay, so why does it apply to substantially prevailing party?
Because it's the distinction between prevailing, which requires a judgment on the merits, versus substantially prevailing party, where it requires you to establish some relief prior to a judgment on the merits. In essence,
where are you deriving that definition?
It comes from the discussions in the development of this statute as Congress developed it through Ruckelshaus and the amendment in response to Gorsuch. So in the 1970s, 1365D only had the whenever appropriate standard, which allowed Congress stated that they wanted the catalyst theory to allow an award of relief short of judgments on the merits. The D.C. Circuit in Sierra Club v. Gorsuch ruled that that wherever appropriate standard allows an award at any time, even if the party obtains no relief whatsoever. And the Supreme Court overruled that in Ruckelshaus. But when Congress wanted to clarify 1365 to say that Gorsuch was wrongly decided, the question was, how can they establish the language that would allow parties to continue to receive fees under the catalyst theory where they would have relief short of judgment on the merits? And it seems that based on the existing case laws out there, substantially prevailing party would be the standard that you would choose. However,
are you saying there's some legislative history you can direct us to that where the members of Congress said that, or that there's a committee report or something that says substantially prevailing party under this statute is to include the catalyst theory?
No, when they amended the statute to include the substantially prevailing party, what Congress said was that they wanted to reinforce their prior stated intent of the catalyst theory by noting in the Senate report, number 9950, 99th Congress, first session, page 33, that fees could be awarded to a party that achieved, quote, a successful settlement. So once they introduced the language of prevailing or substantially prevailing party, if they wanted to be a prevailing party statute only, then an award under a successful settlement would not qualify under the standard of Buchanan.
Wouldn't a successful settlement typically be approved by the court pursuant to a consent judgment?
You can get a consent judgment entered through the court, but there's no requirement. I mean, parties settle and required to give notice of settlement without such consent. So it's our position that if Congress had intended a consent decree to be required, it would have been included in the description that is there. And besides, if that were the case, why would you need to include substantial prevailing party? Why not just stop at prevailing party?
I suppose if Congress intended for the catalyst theory to remain, they would have included it in addition to this inclusion, express inclusion of the settlement option, but they didn't.
Well, they left in the language about whenever appropriate. They added prevailing party to indicate that an award of fees is appropriate when a party receives judgment on the merits. But they included substantial prevailing party to indicate that in some instances they may have
obtained. I mean, I thought the whole basis for this change in the statute was as a result of that D.C. Circuit case, which was in fact overruled by the Supreme Court, which makes me wonder why they needed to change the statute in any event. But Congress wanted to be clear that in no case should a party receive an award where it didn't win on anything. And that's what they were trying to get at here. So why is it reasonable to conclude that this had nothing at all to do with a catalyst theory of recovery? And Congress was simply making it clear that if you prevail entirely, you're entitled to an award of fees. If you substantially prevail, i.e. prevail on some of the claims at issue and a judgment is entered on those portions of the case, you get an award. But if you don't, otherwise, you get nothing.
Well, Your Honor, that's the position that was raised by the EPA in this case about this idea that prevailing party would succeed on all claims and substantial prevailing party would be only some claims. But the problem with that is that, first, the district court didn't say that. They said issues, not claims. But even if that were true, the EPA would still be wrong, because that would mean that under a prevailing party statute, a party would have to win on every claim in order to obtain fees. And the Supreme Court rejected that in Hensley versus Eckert, where it held that litigants should be allowed, in good faith, to raise alternative legal grounds for a desired outcome. And the court's rejection of or failure to reach certain grounds is not a sufficient reason for reducing a fee.
Well,
the result.
This is an ideal, but why couldn't you simply interpret those phrases differently depending on the context? So prevailing in those other statutes includes substantially prevailing. But here, given the problem that Congress sought to remedy, we're going to look at it differently.
Well, so in essence, with Gorsuch, what was decided was the court had discretion to award where a party received not only no judgment in its favor, though no relief of any kind, even before judgment on the merits. So that is our interpretation of why Congress decided to include substantially prevailing party. And even in Ruckelshaus, the court invited Congress to come and step in and address this issue of what they use partially prevailing parties. But the same issue was there, that we're dealing with a standard that is less than a requirement for obtaining relief on the merits.
Can I ask you a question about it sort of relates to Judge Diaz's question. So I thought that the entire premise of the EPA's argument, and it goes to how much attention we can pay to the specific legislative history in this case, because I thought the entire premise of the EPA's, I'm sorry, yeah, the, not the EPA, the, your opponent's argument here is that in, Buchanan, the Supreme Court says this is what prevailing party means. And this is what it means everywhere. You can't really be context specific. Like prevailing party means prevailing party, period. And that's the whole reason we're here, because otherwise there'd be no particular reason to think that back in the 1980s, Congress intended this Buchanan meaning for prevailing party. But Buchanan says it applies to every time prevailing party is used. And so I have some questions about whether we can even really look at the legislative history here. But also, I do see that Buchanan itself says you're a prevailing party even if you've only prevailed on some of your claims. So I think we have to understand when Congress said prevailing party in this Clean Water Act statute, prevailing party itself already incorporated both. You have to win on the merits, but also it's fine if it's only some of the claims.
Well,
is that clear? I'm not sure I'm speaking clearly.
I think the issue is that Congress was not entirely clear on what they wanted. They put the or in there. Our assumption is those terms have to mean something separate. It's entirely possible if you win on the merits, you would prevail and substantially prevail. But in some instances, you could win without a judgment on the merits, and you would substantially prevail but yet not have the judgment on the merits. Therefore, you wouldn't be a prevailing party. So, and besides, this court has ruled previously in OVEC that the presence of the whenever appropriate standard allows the the catalyst theory to apply and that the Buchanan case law does not apply. So the ultimate issue here is we have a statute that has three different provisions, and every other case that we're dealing with really only has one or two of those particular the provisions that are in there. Yes, it is a prevailing party standard, but it's also a substantial prevailing party. And what does that mean? It is our position that Congress added that to ensure that parties can obtain relief short of a judgment.
Well, to try to capsulize two questions I have for all the parties. One is, it would seem like that the substantially prevailing party would have to be some sort of subset of prevailing parties. And I'm not sure if you introduce the catalyst theory that would be true. And secondly, if the catalyst theory applies, and I think everybody probably agrees with this, in the where appropriate or the discretionary fee awards, what if it also applies in a substantially prevailing category in this statute as you present it, what's left for the other two categories, where appropriate and discretionary, to do?
So the first question I would answer – oh, sorry, my time is up. You want me to continue?
Well, I think this is – go ahead.
I can address it on rebuttal if you'd
– Well, go ahead and take a minute now.
Sure. When you talk about the subset of prevailing parties, the question is the subset the parties that obtains the relief it requested or the subset that obtains a final judgment on the merits? Those are not necessarily the same thing. And so it's our position that the subset of prevailing party that you mentioned, we're talking about obtaining the relief but not getting the judgment. And that's the substantially prevailing party. In terms of the four different categories, it's our position that substantially prevailing party, whenever appropriate, and the any party are relatively similar in their discretion, that the court can do pretty much anything it wants short of the Ruckelhaus ban on awarding fees for parties that didn't win anything at all. They didn't got no relief.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Keeney?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did I get that right?
You did.
All right. We'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Derek Teeney, and I am here today with leave of the court on behalf of Amici Curiae, Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, the West Virginia Rivers Coalition, and Sierra Club. And Amici are grateful for the opportunity to speak on this important legal question. I want to start with the questions that you asked, Judge Agee, because you suggested that they were questions for every party in the case. And if I understood you correctly, if we look at substantially prevailing, perhaps it has to be a subset of what a prevailing party is. So then you have to start with what is a prevailing party. And Hensley, which was the Supreme Court law at the time that Congress rewrote the amendments in 1987, told us that a prevailing party was a party that had prevailed on some aspect of their case. So something short of total success was already available as a prevailing party. You add the Farrar and Buchanan requirement of a judicial imprimatur, the court order, and that gives us today's definition of prevailing party. Prevail on some issues, but with a judicial imprimatur. Well, what does a substantially prevailing party mean? Well, this court addressed that question already in Reinbold v. Evers. Just 4 years after it, en banc, became the first court in the country to reject the catalyst theory under prevailing party statutes, this court applied and held that the catalyst theory did apply to the fee-shifting provision of the Privacy Act. And the fee-shifting provision of the Privacy Act allows awards to complainants who have substantially prevailed. So that catalyst theory has historically been part of this court's consideration of what substantially prevailed means. And that case has never been overturned, and it remains the law of this circuit, and therefore should control in this case. Now, the question is, the next part of your question was, if the catalyst theory does apply, well, what does that mean about the whenever appropriate language?
Was that before or after Buchanan?
Well, that case predated Buchanan. It was 1 year before Buchanan. But, of course, this Buchanan was a review of this court's decision, and this court had become the first appellate court in the country to reject the catalyst theory under prevailing party statutes, became the sole outlier in 1994 with the S1 and S2 case. 5 years later, a panel of this court, against the backdrop of having rejected the catalyst theory for a prevailing party statute, went ahead and said, Catalyst theory is perfectly appropriate in the case of a substantially prevailing party statute. This court had acknowledged that distinction already pre-Buchanan, and nothing about Buchanan undermines that. And in fact, Hart tells us, in Hart, Justice Thomas cautioned courts, warned courts, not to just blindly apply Buchanan to any statute. Instead, it must give consideration to the language. And here, the consideration of the language tells us that there are at least two categories of eligible parties, those that are prevailing parties and those that are substantially prevailing. And as I said, in this case, in this court in Reinbold said substantially prevailing parties are those that meet the catalyst theory.
Is there any other fee-shifting statute that you're aware of that puts three of these categories together like this one does?
I'm not aware of any, no, Your Honor. Originally, this language in the Clean Water Act squared up really nicely with the Clean Air Act, which is not surprising because Congress borrowed large parts of the Clean Water Act from the Clean Air Act. And it was the Clean Air Act fee-shifting provision that was at issue in Gorsuch and Ruckelshaus. And so Congress... even though the amendment – and this kind of speaks to the legislative history just a little bit, and why did they go ahead and do this if Ruckelshaus had already been decided? In 1987, that's when the amendment happened. But Congress had worked for years on trying to generate a whole package of amendments for the Clean Water Act, and it had been part of several congressional sessions prior to that. So there were conversations going on prior to the finality of Ruckelshaus that may have informed why this was ending up in the Clean Water Act. But really, I think you've got to give, separate meaning to these two provisions, and that's where EPA's position in this case falls short. Because EPA would violate the cases that Judge Harris was talking about, where Buchanan says, and where this court has held as well, in the Smythe case, that prevailing party must be interpreted consistently regardless of context. Well, EPA's position violates that principle, and for that reason, they have yet to explain how they can square the circle and fit their position within the whole body of prevailing party case law. With that, I'll respectfully request that the court reverse the district court below. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Roundtree?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Tamara Roundtree for the United States. The threshold issue in this case is a straightforward question of what authority the Court should use to interpret the Clean Water Act's fee eligibility standard. Now, in that standard, the sole standard is prevailing or substantially prevailing party. Now, there are two categories of authorities on which the Court should rely. The first is the category that consists of Supreme Court and Fourth Circuit precedents that provide an undisputed definition, to your point, Judge Harris, an undisputed definition of the root term of the Act standard. The second category of...
An undisputed definition of prevailing party.
Correct, yes.
Which already includes you prevail on the merits on some claims.
Yes, correct. Okay. Now, the second category consists of precedents from several circuits that have interpreted the exact...
Before, I want to make sure in your answer to Judge Harris's question, I took some of your argument on brief, perhaps incorrectly, to mean if a party filed a complaint and it had five counts and it went to verdict and it came back and you got a verdict on three counts but not on the other two, you would not count that as a prevailing party.
It depends. The question, did the party prevail in the lawsuit? And are you looking at did it prevail on particular claims or did it prevail on a particular claim? So it's a question of extent and degree.
I'm sorry. I thought your answer to my question was that we know from Buchanan, which provides one definition of prevailing mm-hmm. that goes across context, that when the Clean Water Act uses the phrase prevailing party, it means you won on the merits on some. It includes winning on the merits on some but not all of your claims. And I thought your brief said that the work that is done in this statute by substantially prevailing is that covers you win on some but not all of your claims. So how do you reconcile those two things?
I think I hear the court asking, perhaps what is the range, what is the extent that's covered in the Clean Water Act's language, because it speaks to prevailing party or substantially prevailing party.
Right.
And I
so
think
as you're answering that, to go back to the hypothetical I gave you, if a party comes in and asks for fees and they've won on 3 out of 5 counts in their complaint, are they considered a prevailing party or a substantially prevailing
party? A court could view that as substantially prevailing, because you said 3 out of 5, which could be considered substantially.
Sorry, but could a court view that as not being a prevailing party, given that Buchanan says expressly, if you prevail on some but not all of your claims, you are a prevailing party?
I'm sorry, you're saying
could a court think I understand your argument that a court might think that you are substantially prevailing if you win on 3 out of 5 claims.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't a court also have to think that you are prevailing?
Well, yes. And yes.
So then a court would also have to think you are prevailing. What work, in your view, does the additional language or substantially prevailing do in this statute? It's not necessary to cover people who prevail on some but not all of their claims. So what does it do?
The attachment that we are speaking of is the Buchanan's definition. Under Buchanan, prevailing party can prevail on some claims. We are speaking of a provision that was written in 1987 before Buchanan.
The entire argument is that we have to import from Buchanan the rest of the definition of prevailing into prevailing party, that it requires a win on the merits, it requires judicial imprimatur.
Yes.
Your entire argument, as I understand it, is all of that part of Buchanan has to, by the terms of Buchanan, be imported into this statute. So why don't we import the rest of the sentence that says on some but not all of the claims? How can you split it up that
way? I'm sorry, and I don't see the problem. Perhaps it's because what we're saying is Buchanan defines prevailing party. Prevailing party is the root term of the standard in this case.
So try this one more time, because I genuinely don't understand. Buchanan defines the root term prevailing.
Correct,
party.
Which applies to both prevailing and substantially prevailing party.
And
yes.
It defines prevailing party by itself without the modifier substantial,
okay,
to include winning on some but not all of your claims,
okay,
with judicial imprimatur. If that is so, I don't understand the government's position about what the extra word you can win by. Then what work in this statute does substantially prevailing do if it is not necessary to cover cases where people win on some but not all of their claims?
Congress apparently decided that clarification that you can win on some but not all was needed, because the phrase prevailing or substantially prevailing party can be read as you prevail on all claims or you prevail on substantially all claims. Congress, by putting it substantially, simply said what Buchanan is also saying. It can be all claims or it can be some or substantially all of the claims. So
we're allowed, you think under Buchanan, we can go back and figure out not what those words mean today, but what Congress might have thought they meant in 1987?
I don't see that they aren't reconcilable. As I said, I'm simply...
Congress knew in 1987 that prevailing party already covered winning on some but all of your claims.
By saying substantially prevailing party, that's how Congress got to that. That's how I see Congress got to that point. And I apologize if I'm missing your point.
I'm sure I'm not being clear.
But the point I was trying
Are you suggesting that for purposes of this statute, these words, which Judge Harris indicated in Ruckelhaus, whatever the name of the case is,
okay,
prevailing party doesn't flow across to this particular statute, but because we have these three definitions, prevailing, substantially prevailing, they mean something different?
No. I'm saying the opposite of what you're
okay
saying. Because we have one standard in the Act, it's prevailing or substantially prevailing party. That's the standard. The root term of that entire standard is prevailing party. So we have a definition for prevailing party. Therefore, it must apply. It's an inextricable and essential element of the fee eligibility standard here. So it applies across the board.
So it's substantially prevailing party and a prevailing party in this statute the same thing?
They have the same root term. They are distinguished
only by... Are they the same
by-
thing? I mean, that's the, as I understand, part of the argument from your opposing counsel is that because they are two terms separated by the disjunctive, that they have to have some type of dissimilar meaning. Otherwise, the substantially prevailing party term is superfluous. So I think that's what all our questions are going to, is that what's the difference between a prevailing party and a substantially prevailing party? Or are you saying that this was just some committee staffer who was drinking too much the night they were putting this thing together?
No, let me try it this way. Borrowing what from some of what you've said, Judge Harris, the term prevailing party has, this is undisputed, legal term of art, is to be interpreted consistently across all fee-shifting statutes, regardless of context. Okay, so we have this term. We plop it into the Clean Water Act. It couldn't be more clear. It has got to have the same meaning in the Clean Water Act. It's the root term. It has got to mean the same thing, and it's got to require judicial imprimatur regardless. All right, so the question becomes, we have this slight linguistic change. We've added the adjective, the simple adjective, substantially. What did that do? Well, let's think about it. If we had a standard that said substantially prevailing party, partially prevailing party, by the skin of your teeth, prevailing party, you still have to be a prevailing party.
Okay, so then we should read the phrase substantially prevailing party to mean substantially prevailed on the merits on some but not all of your claims. Because we know prevailing party means prevailed on the merits on some but not all of your claims. So we should read, we think that that means you substantially prevailed.
Indeed.
So then what work is the word substantially doing?
It's differential. Perhaps I can start with the gradations. Prevailing has got to be something here. Substantially is something less.
Less, then it's already incorporated into prevailing. Why would Congress have needed to say, if substantially is a subset of prevailing, why couldn't Congress just have said prevailing party?
It just simply wanted to make clear to courts, it doesn't, if the court for some reason, because this is before Buchanan, if the court for some reason, Congress clearly could have thought, if a court thinks prevailing means prevailing on every claim, we want to make it clear to you, courts, you don't have to prevail, the party doesn't have to prevail on every claim. It can prevail on substantially all claims.
Well, that's at least an argument, but I suppose the other point is, even if there's some concern about what these terms mean, I don't know, what's the argument for importing a catalyst theory of recovery into substantially prevailing?
I don't know what the argument is. There isn't. Because as I said, given that prevailing party is to, the definition of prevailing party is to apply consistently across all fee-shifting statutes, there is no way that all of a sudden the catalyst theory can be inserted into the term substantially prevailing party and deprive that term of its core meaning, which is what the other side is suggesting. Somehow the term substantially prevailing party loses all meaning and is morphed and comes back as a bigger beast being the catalyst theory.
Well, can I tell you what the theory might be? Is that in Pierce versus Underwood, the court talks about, the Supreme Court, how there are two different meanings, somewhat contradictory, of substantial, and it's a fee case, although a slightly different context. And they say sometimes substantial means very, like you prevailed, but you prevailed by a lot. But sometimes it means not formally, but functionally. You didn't formally prevail, but functionally, in substance, you got what you were after. So I think it's that meaning that would allow you to think maybe substantially prevailing captures the catalyst theory.
If that were the case, given the climate in which the Clean Water Act was amended, I certainly think Congress would have been more specific in saying that, particularly because the act originally read as one that could envelop or encompass the catalyst theory. This was Congress's attempt to change it, and had it wanted to maintain any of the life that it originally had.
I genuinely struggle with this because I think the language in Buchanan, which you rely on very heavily in your argument, saying context doesn't matter. We don't care what the context of the statute is. Prevailing means prevailing. If we think that is true, and I think that's an odd way to, I struggle with that because context matters everywhere else, so why wouldn't it matter here? But if that's true, does the legislative history and sort of imagining what Congress might have thought in 1987, are we allowed to do any of that, or are we just really stuck with what the court said in Buchanan? It doesn't matter what Congress would have thought in 1987. All that matters is that here and now, this is what prevailing party means.
I think the court, the court can choose to ignore the legislative history to the extent the court deems it.
How you read that language in Buchanan that says context doesn't matter. This is a term of art. Don't look at context. I'm asking for the government's position
on whether that should be. Well, it's actually precedent under Supreme Court and this court.
In light of that, we can look at the legislative. We may look at the legislative history, whether it is relevant what Congress was thinking about in 1987.
It's there for the court to consider. I don't know that the court cannot consider it. I'm afraid of going into a trap that I don't understand.
Question about whether you think we should look at the legislative.
I think indeed the court can look to the legislative history, particularly given that we started with a statute that read one way and was changed to read another way.
I just have a slight follow up. So we can look at the legislative history, and so if the legislative history indicated something different about the meaning of prevailing, could we look at that after Buchanan? There is no trap here. I would say not.
No, if this court has accepted what's in Buchanan, so if the precedent is what's in Buchanan and the definition of prevailing party, and so it applies. If it applies, it's in the statute. That's how it should be read. And judicial imprimatur is required. The baseline, perhaps we can all take comfort in knowing the baseline requirement of prevailing party is that there's got to be judicial imprimatur. So parsing as to what's prevailing, is it some, all, three, five, I don't know is absolutely necessary that we do it. What we know is the bottom line, though, is that there must be judicial imprimatur, which was missing in this case. Perhaps I can offer the court.
So let me follow up on Judge Harris's question, because I don't think you're suggesting that Congress couldn't attach different meanings to different words and statutes, right? They can certainly disagree with the Supreme Court
Indeed.
And say, you're wrong.
Yes.
And this statute, this Clean Water Act, substantially prevailed means something different than in any other statute. And I guess what Judge Harris is getting at is whether or not the legislative history in this case supports a different meaning for substantially prevailing. What do you think?
A different meaning than?
Different than in Buckhauser and the other cases that suggest that it's a straight meaning all across the board.
I think it's got consistent meaning in the legislative history and in Buchanan, and particularly because the bottom line is judicial imprimatur. I would just refer this court to its decision in S1 and S2, which was decided back in 1994. The court, it was a prevailing party statute. The court defined prevailing party and again acknowledged that it requires judicial imprimatur, which is what Buchanan said, which is what we're saying is required here.
In this particular case, if I'm remembering the district court's opinion correctly, the district court seemed to say, for purposes of this act, a prevailing party and a substantially prevailing party are basically the same thing. And because of that, we're going to apply the Buchanan requirement to have the judicial order in order for there to be a fee recovery. So was the district court's approach correct?
With all due respect, I think that's a slight misinterpretation or potential misinterpretation of what the district court said. I don't think the district court meant to either collapse the two or say they are exactly the same. I think what the district court was acknowledging that we have this phrase prevailing party that has got to apply whether you're talking about substantially prevailing party or prevailing party. The requirements of prevailing party must.
Let me ask this a different way. In order for you to prevail, in other words, for the court to hold the catalyst theory does not apply, is it necessary that we differentiate between prevailing party and substantially prevailing
Your Honor,
party
no.
as a matter of law?
No. Particularly because, as I started, the standard here is prevailing or substantially prevailing party. That is what we're trying to figure out the definition of, not parsing the creating two different words. Congress could have said a prevailing party or substantially prevailing party, and perhaps then we'd have to have this discussion. We don't, because as it's worded, it's a unique phraseology, but it's what's there and it's what we're stuck with. That's what we have to deal with. And again, I said, as the root term of the sole standard in this case, prevailing party has got to have meaning across the board. If I might just address the Reinbold case, which was raised by Amiki, Reinbold, it has no application here. Reinbold is one in a line of cases that involves the Privacy Act. The Privacy Act has the fee provision requirement that a claimant substantially prevail, period. That's the language. Reinbold, along with a long line of cases prior to it, Court of Appeals cases, recognized that that phrase, substantially prevailed, should be construed using cases that have construed FOIA, which had exactly the same language, substantially prevailed. The cases, the Court of Appeals cases that have addressed this accept this and do not even question it. As a matter of fact, in Reinbold, there's a case by the name of Sweat in which the D.C. Circuit actually said that the cases that construe FOIA establish doctrine for analyzing the Privacy Act case. And again, the Privacy Act case was at issue in Reinbold. To the extent the court has any question as to the fact that Reinbold stands for the proposition that Privacy Act cases and FOIA cases should be analyzed correctly in terms of their fee provision. Every case that has cited to Reinbold after it was decided has been a FOIA case or a Privacy Act case. The sole case that cited to it and wasn't privacy or FOIA was the OVEC District Court case that has been submitted to this court in a 28J letter. And tellingly, if the court looks at the way the OVEC case, the district court case, cites to the Reinbold holding, it doesn't use the entire test that's used for that substantially prevailing test in those separate set of cases. It removes the language that's specific to FOIA, specific to Privacy Act cases, which actually is language that speaks to the release of records. And if I might, the test for the Privacy Act and FOIA cases is that the fee applicant must establish that his Privacy Act claim was reasonably necessary and substantially caused by the requested records to be released. And substantially caused the requested records to be released. In the OVEC decision, the court removed the reference to requested records that were to be released and simply refers to it as relief. I simply want to make sure that the court understands that that case has no application here. It's not the same standard and doesn't control.
Thank you very much. Mr. Niffler, you get the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to answer Judge Agee's question about his example of a 5 counts, 3 wins with the judicial imprimatur. So the Supreme Court ruled in Hensley in 1983 that if we were dealing with a prevailing party standard, that having 5 counts, 3 wins means you are a prevailing party. There's no question about substantial prevailing party was issued. The fact they didn't win on all claims doesn't matter. They have prevailed. So, again, this construction that EPA is offering about substantially prevailing party is superfluous. It already exists within the context of the prevailing party case law. Second, I wanted to address also the question about Hart. You'd asked about the 4 categories in Hart. The Supreme Court actually broke these into 3 groups. It said most fee-shifting provisions permit a court to award attorney's fees for only to a prevailing party. That's group one. Others permit a substantially prevailing party or a successful litigant to obtain parties. That's 2. And then the other ones are authorized district courts award attorney's fees where appropriate or discretion. So our point is that perhaps the last category is even more wide open. Maybe you win on an insubstantial issue before the court, but within this context of substantially prevailing party or successful, success requires you achieve some relief that you have requested, but short of a ruling on the merits. In this instance, we're asking that substantially prevailing party must mean something. It was included by Congress. They used the word or. Congress could have stopped a prevailing party, and they didn't. It has to mean something. So with that, we ask then that the court find that 33 U.S.C. 1365D authorizes fee awards under the caddis theory for substantially prevailing parties like the board. We ask that you reverse the district court's denial of our motion for attorney's fees and order the DPA award fees in our favor. Any further questions?
Thank you very much.